All right. Welcome to episode 10 of Understanding Latin American Politics, the podcast. I'm Greg Weeks. I am a political scientist at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. And today I'm talking with Tim Gill, who's a postdoctoral fellow at the Center for Inter-American Policy and Research at Tulane University. And he recently finished his PhD in sociology from the University of Georgia, right? This year you finished, is that right?
I did, yes. Officially awarded in August. So
okay. Congratulations. Now it's the hard part.
Right,
All right, so Tim studies Venezuela, and for the past week, the world's been watching the U.S. presidential election mostly, and things will start switching back to conflicts like Venezuela. Interestingly enough, the Venezuelan opposition, their spokesperson told the U.S., well, good luck with that after Donald Trump was elected. Sort of funny, even though Trump might help them, sort of said, okay, good luck.
Right.
But one thing that you had, I have questions that kind of go all over the place, but you had written in the Monkey Cage about whether we should compare Donald Trump to Hugo Chavez, which actually generated some pretty interesting discussion. For some reason, people have strong feelings about this. So let's resolve this. Should Trump be compared to Chavez?
You know, as I wrote in the piece, you know, I don't see much substantive similarity between the two. I mean, I think, you know, surely we could talk about the stylistic similarities between the two, but I think when you get down to the substance of what it is that Trump has proposed and what it is that Chavez stood for, I don't think that the comparison is all that worthwhile. I mean, you think about Trump, you know, certainly been on our minds this past week intensively. You know, he made bigotry the centerpiece of his campaign. You know, he definitely fanned the flames of racial resentment, racism, and he made derogatory comments about nearly any vulnerable population that you can think about. You know, he made derogatory comments about referring to Mexicans as rapists, as murderers, as comments likening Muslims to terrorists, talking about Syrian refugees, Black Lives Matter protesters, you know, saying that he was, you know, people should knock them around and he'll pay the bills, making the comments he said about women and, you know, to say nothing about his entire history of comments before the campaign. So, you know, some of these ideas, of course, found their way into policy positions. Some didn't. You know, he, you know, obviously mocked the disabled. And, right. You know, he wasn't talking about repealing the ADA or anything, but he certainly was talking about building a wall. He's talking about extreme vetting of individuals from, you know, Muslim-majority countries. My wife, for instance, is from an immigrant from Albania, and which is a Muslim-majority country. And many individuals from her family are still trying to come over here to the U.S. And so, you know, that's extremely worrisome. Now, I do think that both Chavez and Trump seized upon very real economic anxieties, you know, the ill effects of globalization, problems with free trade agreements and so on. I mean, the economic problems are very real in many parts of the U.S. You know, we certainly have escalating inequality. And were very real and continue to be very real in Venezuela. So I think that both, you know, certainly were able to seize upon these issues of economic inequality. You know, Hillary, on the other hand, you know, Bernie as well as Trump, you know, talked about her getting these $250,000fees for getting $250,000 for speeches, you know, on Wall Street. And you know, she was on the board of directors for Walmart, among other corporations. She wavered on TPP, you know, stood by NAFTA. And, you know, in the end of the day, Trump, you know, did well enough in the Midwest, you know, an area that's been hit hard by some of these policies. And so, you know, he ended up winning. I mean, the polls got it wrong. But the reality is that he was able to seize upon these very real economic anxieties that exist. I think it's also true, you know, that both are outsiders in the political sense. I mean, I think that, you know, they're obviously it's hard for me to think about Trump and Chavez given the backgrounds, you know, given Trump's upbringing, given Chavez's upbringing. But, you know, it's true. Both were political outsiders. I mean, Chavez had his own party. Trump worked through the Republican Party. But, you know, he wasn't a governor. He wasn't a senator. He was this business guy and a pretty enfranchised guy. But he represented change, I think, in a certain sense that Chavez did. You know, there are concerns about corruption in the late 20th century. I mean, there still are concerns about corruption, rightfully so, in Venezuela. There are concerns and about corruption in Washington and concerns about, you know, seriously low levels of competence in Congress and so on. And Trump has talked about draining the water in D.C. So I think that, you know, there is some overlap, talking about corruption, talking about economic anxieties, a critique of free trade. But I think that a better comparison for Trump is with the far right in Europe. You know, people like Le Pen, who have also seized upon bigotry, talked about undocumented immigrants coming in, taking jobs, and so on and so forth. And with Chavez, I mean, I think the better comparison really is with Bernie, who also talked about economic anxieties, but didn't make bigotry a centerpiece of his campaign. Of course, he, you know, didn't want any association with Chavez and Venezuela, but I think that's the better comparison.
Okay, and you say, earlier you said it's not worthwhile because it can be sort of analytically fun to do it, but then ultimately you figure we can't draw any useful conclusions out of this exercise.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, perhaps there's something to be said about a very intensive academic study that looks at the similarities, the differences, and really gets into everything, looking at Trump and Chavez. But I think that, you know, it just seemed to me, with all the articles that were coming out, that it made for a nice headline. Trump, let's compare Trump and Chavez, and it's very superficial. And talking about, you know, well, Chavez had a TV show and he had people call in and he sat in front of the television and he sang and he read poetry and he danced. And Trump had this television program, The Apprentice. And I mean, both used television, both had a bombastic personality, but it's not all that. I mean, it just felt all so superficial and just kind of very cheap. I wouldn't say every article, yeah. But I felt like it was just very, very superficial, very, very cheap, and, you know, glossed over much more than it illuminated. And that's what sort of drove me to write that, because it was just recurring everywhere. You know, these sorts of, you know, in the San Diego Herald Tribune, when it endorsed Hillary after having this long period of endorsing Republicans, you know, had all these comments likening, you know, Trump to Chavez. And it just was, I think, as somebody who studies Venezuela, and perhaps when you study something, you know, you tend to perhaps nitpick a bit, but I think it was rightful. You know, I think a lot of these articles were very cheap and superficial and just glossed over and simply didn't illuminate much at all. You know, it's very easy, I think, in the U.S. To target Chavez. You know, I think he wasn't in many instances taken seriously. I think many individuals seized upon the most far-fetched comments that he would say. You know, I remember one instance he talked about, you know, the possibility that capitalism existed on Mars, and perhaps, you know, that's why the country was destroyed, you know, when there was some trace, you know, whatever was discovered, that perhaps there was water. And so, you know, the media would seize upon this and seize upon all these sort of very, very far-fetched, tongue-in-cheek comments that were made by Chavez. And so I, you know, in some ways I saw these kind of comparisons as almost, you know, kind of along the same lines.
Okay. Well, at this point, too, I think we've probably there have been so many articles written on it that we probably don't have – there's not much use of doing more, and we'll just have to wait and see how things work out with a President Trump versus a President Chavez.
Sure, exactly. I think that's a great point, too. I mean, we don't know what – you know, we know what Chavez did. We don't know what, you know, Trump is going to do.
Right. Switching gears a little, so your own research has focused on the Venezuelan government's view of foreign – organizations, foreign NGOs, and a lot has been written about paranoia, both for the Chavez and Maduro governments. Mm-hmm. How much of that do you see as legitimate, and how much is do they have justifiable concerns about foreign influence in Venezuela?
Yeah, I mean that's a really good question. You know, it's interesting because for a long period of time, you know, in the beginning, there was a pretty sturdy relationship between the Venezuelan government and many NGOs. You know, several representatives from some NGOs had input on the constitution that was written, and there was a sort of working relationship between several human rights organizations and the Venezuelan government in the beginning. At least there was a dialogue; they weren't completely cut off. You know, but over time, you know, certainly after the 2002 coup, after the election in 2006, as Venezuela grew closer to Russia, and Russia and Belarus and China were all also cracking down on NGOs, you know, this relationship between the Venezuelan government and many NGOs broke down. You know, at a general level, I do think that a lot of it is paranoia. You know, I think that generally, though, state elites, you know, don't like accountability. They don't like civil society organizations holding them accountable and criticizing them. Now, some countries have pursued more intensive policies than others. Certainly Russia, Belarus, and Venezuela has passed legislation. But I mean, even if you look at diplomatic cables that have been released involving the U.S., you know, there's a lot of attention paid to op-eds in the New York Times and the Washington Post, a lot of attention to the sort of criticism that's leveled against U.S. foreign policy. You know, there are individuals in the policymaking community that were extremely upset when Eva Golinger, for instance, wrote her book, several books criticizing U.S. foreign policy. You know, a lot of her books, of course, involve conspiracy theory and taking a kernel of something and turning it into, you know, a whole mountain. But the point is that I think that state elites in Venezuela and beyond get annoyed with criticism of their policies. In Venezuela, you know, there are NGOs that do a lot of great work, looking at prisons, looking at human rights, monitoring freedom of the press issues, freedom of speech issues. And there are groups that have commended the Venezuelan government for things that they think it's done appropriately, some of the social programs, the communal councils. But there's also been loads of criticism against law enforcement, indigenous policies, prisons and overcrowding. And over time, you know, the Venezuelan government has become increasingly sensitive. Why that is, you know, I think is subject to speculation. You know, why has the Venezuelan government become so sensitive over time? I think there is, you know, some paranoia that the U.S. is working with many NGOs in Venezuela and funding them for the expressed purpose of criticizing the Venezuelan government. And I think that that's simply not the case. Now, are there some NGOs that have posed as being nonpartisan, as being unbiased, but they're clearly partisan? Yeah, I think that's obviously the case. Sumate, for instance, you know, where Maria Corina Machado cut her teeth. You know, this group openly advocated for the recall election against Chavez. You know, it sought to register voters, you know, with the intent that it could register the young and whatnot to vote against Chavez. You know, so I mean, the U.S. funded Sumate, but it didn't fund them, you know, to advocate against Chavez. It funded them for a different sort of you know, get out the vote and all the rest of it, not for partisan endeavors. But this group, you know, is clearly has been clearly against the Chavez government. There's been other groups that the U.S. has funded that have openly aligned with the opposition, have held sort of press conferences outside opposition headquarters. Some leaders from some groups supported transitional government in 2002 in Venezuela. So some NGOs clearly don't hide where they stand on Chavez and on Maduro. And this annoys, as a matter of fact, you know, in many of the interviews that I conducted and individuals that I've spoken with in Venezuela, they get very annoyed with some of these NGOs that sort of pose as being nonpartisan and unbiased, but clearly are, because it gives the NGO community writ large a bad name. And it makes it so much easier for the government to crack down and pass legislation that makes life more difficult for many of these NGOs in Venezuela that indeed do good work.
So how is the environment for NGOs in Venezuela right now, foreign NGOs? Is it pretty closed off or what?
No, I mean, I think that, you know, many of the groups that have been operating since Chavez came to power continue to operate. You know, there's always, you know, the sense that there's going to be a chilling effect, you know, that when the government criticizes NGOs, when the government says it's going to pass more strict legislation, that that groups are going to be quiet, that they're going to shut down, and all the rest of it. You know, Venezuela passed legislation 2010, the Law for the Defense of Political Sovereignty and National Self-Determination, which said if you're a political NGO, if you're focused on very vague language, you know, you're focused on any sort of promotion of political rights, you know, which could be interpreted in any way, electoral observation, anything at all. You know, but there hasn't been one case that's been brought against NGOs. You know, there hasn't been one NGO that's been prosecuted under this piece of legislation, which I find particularly interesting, right? I mean, they passed this piece of legislation. Allegedly, the Venezuelan government is very concerned about U.S. democracy assistance for NGOs in the country. But, you know, the U.S. puts the funding right in its budget, $5 million for Venezuelan civil society groups, you know, openly, right? There's no secret about this, that the National Center for Democracy works in Venezuela, that USAID works in Venezuela, and all the rest of it. But for some reason, the Venezuelan government hasn't prosecuted any groups under this piece of legislation. So, you know, I mean, the legislation is there. There's obviously an acrimonious relationship. At times, some individuals in the Venezuelan government have criticized particular NGO leaders, particular NGOs. But, you know, NGOs still freely operate, and they still put statements out. They still criticize the government on particular issues. And so, you know, certainly you could say it's a perhaps it's a difficult and sensitive environment. But we don't see NGOs being, you know, shut down left and right.
Okay. And kind of following along with the issue of the United States, what's your take on the effectiveness of the targeted U.S. sanctions that we're seeing, have seen in the past year or two?
Yeah, personally, I don't see much utility in the targeted sanctions. I mean, those involved, what, seven individuals from, you know, security forces, and I don't really see that they accomplished really much of anything. I mean, labeling Venezuela as well as this extraordinary threat to the U.S. is kind of, it's rather comical. I know that it was sort of, you know, that was the language that needed to be utilized, but it's just, it just makes for this sort of, I think, comical situation, the language. And I don't really see, as far as the targeted sanctions themselves, you know, I mean, what did they accomplish? The U.S. expresses its dismay with particular individuals. Maybe it appeases some groups in the U.S. that want to push for tougher policies on Venezuela. You know, other congressional members don't really care about Venezuela that much, so they don't really challenge this move, you know, to call the targeted sanctions. And provides Maduro, I think, with more fodder for his accusations that the U.S. is an imperial power looking to destabilize Venezuela. And that whole, you know, that resonates in Venezuela. You know, the accusations of U.S. involvement in the 2002 coup, regardless of the truth behind that, you know, this resonates in Venezuela, that there is this foreign power, the U.S., which has been an imperial power in the hemisphere. It's seeking to intervene in the country and, you know, labeling the country a security threat. I think these imperial claims, you know, these claims resonate. And so I don't really see, you know, the utility of these sort of targeted sanctions. I mean, you know, especially given the history of U.S., recent history of the U.S. in the country. I mean, the recognition of the Bush administration of the transitional government, how long it took for Obama to recognize, you know, the results involving Maduro and Capriles. I think, you know, it's just perhaps it appeases some groups, but I don't really see much in the way of any sort of accomplishments. You know, I feel like, or I should say it seems like that more has come out of discussions than this sort of targeted sanctions or any sort of sanctions that have been applied over the years to the Venezuelan government. Yeah, so I don't see much utility in the targeted sanctions. I know that there's, you know, disagreement on that, but that's my, you know, take on.
So let me ask you a two-pronged question then. In the, what do you think then would be the most useful U.S. response moving forward? But then, just purely speculating, what do you think we might see under President Trump moving forward with Venezuela?
Right.
And you got to say President Trump. That's a real thing. We actually have to start saying
President.
This.
Yeah, right. So moving forward, I mean, I think it's at this point, you know, the public criticisms, you know, there was very intense public criticisms of Venezuela, especially during the Bush administration. You had individuals like Nancy Pelosi calling Chavez a thug. You know, there's been that he's an authoritarian, that he is a dictator. And I think none of that, all this sort of public intensive tit for tat sort of criticism really went anywhere. I mean, for all the years of criticism and trying to allegedly push Venezuela in the right direction, I mean, we see where we are right now with Maduro. We see the whole situation. So, you know, I mean, that's not blaming the U.S. in any sort of way, but I don't see much in the way of accomplishments. I think right now, you know, it's best for the U.S. to work with other countries in the region. You know, Venezuela is certainly sensitive to international criticism, specifically from the U.S., but I think that they're, you know, that perhaps Venezuela will listen to other actors. You know, that, yeah, I mean, I don't know about Brazil today. In the past, certainly I think Brazil had the ear of Venezuela. But even so, I mean, I think it's worthwhile to try to work with other countries to put pressure on Venezuela. I think, you know, these closed-door sessions involving Tom Shannon and Maduro seem to be more worthwhile than the public criticism and the sanctions and so forth, and could perhaps lend themselves to a better relationship between the two countries and perhaps to, you know, more sort of democratic movement, let's say, in Venezuela. I think right now, I think it's best to wait and see, you know, what comes out of this dialogue involving UNASUR and the Vatican. You know, obviously, Maduro has is very interested. I think it's you know, I mean, Maduro didn't have to go to the Vatican, didn't have to say, hey, let's come in and have some sort of mediation. Could have just went ahead, no recall election, and that's that. So I think it's positive that the Vatican's in the country, that there's at least some dialogue going on between the two groups, the government, the opposition. What's going to come out of it, it's not clear, but I think it's good to wait and see at least what can come out of it. Because, I don't even think it could very easily have not been a possibility. And so I think that's a positive step in the right direction. You know,
so,
at least,
but is President Trump a wait-and-see guy?
it's so hard to say. What
I know, I'm putting you on the spot, though.
Sure. No, but it's fun. Yeah, no, it's definitely fun to think about. The Venezuelan government congratulated, sent its congratulations to Trump the other day. You know, there's been a lot of discussion and thinking about, you know, Trump's going to have this good relationship with Russia. Venezuela has this good relationship with Russia. You know, what's that going to mean for Venezuela? You know, Trump wants to work with Putin. Who knows? I mean, you know, in that logic, you know, perhaps he wants to work with a Maduro, you know, but there was a comment that he expressed. I don't remember verbatim the words, but he expressed solidarity with the Venezuelan opposition. So it's not entirely clear. I mean, everything just seems so up in the air. I've never, you know, politically and thinking about politics and the future, things have never felt just so unpredictable, you know? And so it's hard to say. I mean, I could see Trump cracking down on Venezuela, no dialogue. We have to sanction more individuals. I could see Trump saying, well, you know, we should work with Maduro. He's, you know, it's better that we have allies in the world. You know, we're working with Putin. Why not try to work with Maduro as well? I mean, he's all over the place. And so I could barely, very easily see, a multitude of responses from Trump on Venezuela. I mean, it's interesting because, you know, every time the U.S. criticizes Venezuela, you know, Venezuela will come back and say, well, you know, look at the killing of unarmed black men in the U.S. and you talk about democracy. Look at immigrant rights and the deportations. You know, look at that you had Bush elected and he didn't win the popular vote. I mean, you know, and then given the bigotry that Trump has placed front and center, you know, any sort of criticism that would come from Trump, and Trump didn't win the popular vote either. I mean, I feel like, I don't know how seriously, if the Venezuelan government didn't take criticism all that seriously from Bush and Obama, I mean, I can only imagine the response now, you know?
Yeah, no, that's true. So with just a couple minutes remaining, I was going to ask you about foreign political actors, but you did kind of get into that because you were saying the importance of having the Vatican. But I did want to just get to the essential question of what do you think the dialogue in Venezuela can realistically accomplish?
Yeah, yeah, that's a good question. So it seems they have their working groups now looking on rule of law and so forth. And so the actors at least are, you know, coming to the table. But, you know, it's hard to say because the opposition doesn't make it all that easy, I don't think, for the Venezuelan government, because it has historically placed many demands and has said, look, if you don't meet these demands by such and such time, we're not going to dialogue whatsoever. And I'm not sure that's the best strategy to have, you know, just telling the government, hey, listen, if you don't release all the political prisoners, if we don't have the recall election, then that's that, you know, see you later. I think it's possible that the opposition of Maduro could arrive at an agreement to move ahead with the recall election. I mean, I think it's a possibility. You know, I certainly don't hold out too much hope for it, but, you know, there was a dialogue not all that long ago involving the Carter Center and so on, and the recall election was held. So I think it's a possibility. I mean, I think it looks much more dire for Maduro now than it did for Chavez. So perhaps the government is, you know, much more, you know, does not want that to happen, given, you know, his favorability ratings and all the rest of it. I think that maybe the government can find some way to work with the opposition Congress, you know, maybe come to some agreements, you know, working together to boost economic production, perhaps receiving some foreign aid. I mean, the situation involving hospitals and medicine is just horrible. I don't even think I can read another story about, you know, what's going on in the country and just you know, the crisis involving medicine, but that would be great to see. I mean, if there was some sort of agreement, you know, to accept foreign aid that would assist Venezuelan citizens, you know, I think that would be wonderful. But, you know, I mean, yeah, it's all speculation. I mean, I hope it comes to something. You know, I hope that they, you know, can come to an agreement to move ahead with the recall election, to release more opposition activists, to find a way to work with the opposition Congress, you know, to receive some foreign aid and to, you know, which ultimately helps out the Venezuelan citizen. So that's my hope. You know, you never know.
No. Okay. Well, we are out of time, and I'm glad then we end on a note of at least cautious optimism, which with Venezuela is not necessarily always that common. And then, yeah, the hope and what's going to happen, you know, might diverge. But sure. So Tim Gill is a postdoctoral fellow at the Center for Inter-American Policy and Research at Tulane University, and recently finished his PhD in sociology from the University of Georgia. So, Tim, thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you, Greg. I very much appreciate it.